I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. There are deep political divisions in this country, and people on all sides tend to think that their beliefs are not just correct, but also well-reasoned, deeply principled, and good for the country. Our guests Jason Whedon and Robert Kurzban say that self-interest has more to do with our political beliefs than any abstract notions about justice and fairness. And that applies to taxes and immigration, abortion, same-sex marriage, drugs, affirmative action, and more. They've written their findings in their new book, The Hidden Agenda of the Political Mind, How Self-Interest Shapes Our Opinions and Why We Won't Admit It. They argue that dividing voters into liberal and conservative camps or thinking strictly in party terms misses much of the nuance of how people really think about hot-button issues. Robert Kurzban is a professor of psychology and director of the Pennsylvania Laboratory for Experimental Evolutionary Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, wrote a previous book called Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite, Evolution in the Modular Mind. And Rob Kurzban, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Jason Whedon. He's a D.C.-based psychological researcher, also a senior researcher with the Pennsylvania Laboratory for Experimental Evolutionary Psychology at Penn. And Jason Whedon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times
pleasure.
As well. Rob, let me begin with you. Are you saying we're just selfish? We are just selfish, but we dress it up in some lofty ideology?
Well, I wouldn't say we're just selfish. I think, of course, there's room for ideology to have some effect on our views. And in fact, I think there's lots of cases in which you see that. But certainly what we would want to argue is, yeah, that self-interest is playing a major role.
And what do you mean by self-interest? What does that mean?
Well, in the context of political opinions, it means that you favor policies such that if they were implemented, you would be better off. So if you would be better off with big government transfers, you tend on average to be in favor of high tax rates and big government transfers. If you'd be worse off the other direction, well, that's going to predict your opinion.
Of course, we know there are exceptions to that, Jason. I mean, there are wealthy people in this country who are saying, we need tax reform. I need to pay more taxes than my secretary does, to quote somebody.
Yeah, right. Warren Buffett.
Exactly.
We think about that like, you know, look, if a climate scientist says to you the planet's getting warmer, they're talking about lots of observations over lots of places, over lots of periods of times, and they're telling you about an average. We're social scientists looking at political science data. We're doing the same thing. We're looking at large databases, lots of people, and telling you, sure, on average, you know, if you're talking about economic issues, it's rich white men who are more conservative on average, and poor middle-class minorities are more liberal. But sure, are there cold winters in the Northeast? Yes. Are there cold days in summers? Sure. And that's the same thing with, you know, with guys like Warren Buffett. He's an exception to a general rule.
Do you think there's also something tribal about self-interest, which is that it's not just how I think or how something affects me, but how it affects my tribe, the people in my tribe?
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, you see that very clearly with the rise of identity politics. But we also see it in the context of modern debates about any programs, for example, that are going to benefit some people but not others. So affirmative action or unemployment benefits, anything in which one belongs to a category, the same sort of argument would apply. If you're a member of that category, you very well might be in favor of those policies. And of course, that also might mean your friends, your relatives, people who you associate with, those people would also at the same time benefit from those policies.
But is this something new? The idea that we think and vote in our own self-interest?
Well, that's a great question. So I think what we'll probably find at the bottom of the show is that your callers, many of them will argue that they or the people close to them, they, of course, are not driven by self-interest. They're an exception, and everyone thinks they're an exception. So certainly there are certain stripes of academics and so on who are perfectly comfortable with the idea that self-interest is driving our decisions and opinions. Economists would be probably the best example. But in other parts of the world and in scholarship, there's lots of political scientists who are saying, no, it's not self-interest. There's something wrong with people in Kansas. They're voting against their self-interest. So that's sort of the room for debate.
Well, and to pick up on that, and that goes back to a book that was written about sort of why would working class people favor something like a low estate tax, trying to figure out why would people not vote in – why wouldn't they vote in their self-interest? Take that up, Jason.
Yeah, it's – well, okay. So there's a standard political science answer after that book came out. What's the Matter with Kansas came out, and a number of political scientists just made a very simple empirical point, which is if you look at white voters, the poor white voters are much less likely to be Republicans than the richer white voters. So there's a sense in which – the claims in that book were overdone from the get-go. But then also in our book, you know, one of the things that really is new in our book is we expand self-interest analysis beyond just these economic issues. So we say, yes, there's self-interest going on with economic issues like healthcare spending and tax rates. But there's also self-interest going on in things that you would normally think of as social or cultural issues, things relating to marijuana legalization or abortion or birth control or immigration, you know, that there's really self-interest, that it shows up in very interestingly different ways across different kinds of political issues.
But why would someone who doesn't have a lot of money care about an estate tax? I'm going back to you, Rob.
Well, I mean, so the main thing I would say there is that if you look at things issue by issue, again, what we find really are averages. That if you to take the example of unemployment, for example, if you want to ask the question who on average is going to be in favor of benefits to people who are unemployed, it's going to be people who are unemployed. So again, it's a Buffett case. We don't deny that there's certainly going to be some people who don't have any wealth to pass on who are going to wind up being in favor of you know, reducing estate taxes. But you know, we do feel like on average the evidence is strongly in favor of your being able to predict who's going to be on which side of these issues by looking at where their interests lie.
But we also have political operatives who know how to use language to frame things so that the estate tax becomes the death tax, and all of a sudden people feel like, well, I'm going to die someday. Maybe this will affect me.
Yeah, sure. Right. These kinds of framing effects are real. The kind of language effects are real. But we also find when we go look at that data, if you look at poor whites, they're not routinely conservative on economic issues. In fact, they're typically center-left on economic issues. The real issues where they're conservative are things like abortion and immigration, issues of race. You know, less educated white voters tend to be more conservative on issues of race and immigration. More religious white voters tend to be very conservative on abortion and birth control. So it's not really the economic issues that are driving poorer and less educated whites to be Republican voters. It's really these other kinds of issues where their conservatism is very stout and noticeable.
Well, and I mean, we are all, I think, a mix of opinions about just about everything, and they don't always line up very neatly, liberal, conservative, or Republican, Democrat.
Well, it's interesting you say that. There's quite a robust scholarly literature, and even you see this to some extent in the media, which sort of suggests that what's happening in this country is a polarization where people are getting pushed into camps and that those ideologies are being made more extreme but also homogenized. And when we looked at this, that's not what we find. We find exactly what you're saying, that you can't identify people's specific views on a particular issue by looking at their party affiliation, by looking at their ideology. So we agree with this point. So we do think that people are sort of all over the map in terms of their political opinions. But again, there certainly is an ambiance right now where people are being told that there's homogeneity within the parties, which we don't see.
Well, there's the sort of, you know, the Fox versus MSNBC crowd, I guess.
Yeah, well, and also you have to think about the polarization is very strong in some places and very weak in other places. So if you look at candidates or you look at legislators, very, very strongly polarized. You have people with routinely liberal views and people with routinely conservative views. As you move into and we've looked at these analyses where, you know, you can take different slices of the American public. You can look at very highly educated whites, for example. And they'll tend to be a bit more likely to polarize as well. They'll have views that sort of tend to skew either to the left or to the right. But then you go down to sort of the most of the general public, the mass of the general public. You just don't see any tendency really at all for, say, economic issues, people's views on taxes and spending, to correlate at all with their views on things like abortion or same-sex marriage. They're just completely separate opinion domains when it comes to the mass of public opinion. But you can find groups and, you know, a lot of people we hang out with and a lot of the professorial class and a lot of the political class are people who really do polarize. And so we take that polarization, it's part of our own experience, and we project it onto the whole population. But you go look at the public opinion data, that's not true of the whole population.
I was thinking about the fact that when there are more and more now candidates running for president, I think we have a couple more coming this week and perhaps even next week as well. But it seems that both Republicans and Democrats have latched on to this economic inequality issue, and it's and I think their solutions are probably very different, but it's interesting. And I'm looking at you, Rob. It's interesting that issue has sort of bubbled up to the top.
Yeah, and I think on what one sees in general in the political world is that these issues do sort of come and go. And I think a lot of it is driven by some really nice analyses that one sees from economists that have drawn attention to the kind of inequality. Because again, I think in people's experiences, they don't always see these large differences. And the only way you can kind of see them is by looking at aggregated data, mm-hmm. is by looking at historical trends. And once those data started getting portrayed in the mainstream media and people's attention were drawn to them, then I think it was inevitable that people who are running for office would talk about those issues insofar as, once again, you know, this is what voters' attention is being drawn to, and so they almost have to take a position with respect to those issues.
But it sort of reflects that perhaps people actually do care about this issue, even if they don't feel like they are personally affected by it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, although, you know, one of the things that we know from the social sciences is that people care a lot about comparisons, right? There's these classic studies which ask, would you rather make $80,000 if everyone else made $120,000, or would you rather make, you know, $40,000 if everyone else made $50,000?
What do people say?
Well, people tend to like the world in which they're doing better than other people, even if, as an absolute measure, they're actually worse off. So what that tells us is that people really care about these comparisons. And in essence, that's a large part. At least that's what some people would say is framing the inequality debate.
Survival of the fittest? Is that, I mean, if we're talking about evolutionary psychology, can we boil it down to that?
Well, it's not survival of the fittest, but it is. We are social animals who thrive on comparing ourselves to our social competitors. And so these comparison effects are really psychologically potent for us. It's the visibility of extreme wealth that drives strong opinions towards extreme wealth. But then I also like something you said earlier about, you know, the solutions of the parties are very different on the problem of inequality. And in fact, I think most reasonable people would admit one side is advocating policies that would make inequality better, that would reduce inequality, and another side is advocating policies that would make inequality worse. Mm. And part of our point as psychologists is, in fact, in general, people are very results-oriented in their political opinions. They really the framing of the issue matters, the language you use around an issue matters, but people also really care about what's the bottom line? How does it affect everyday life? And a lot of what's driving the difference in views of Democrats and Republicans on these issues has to do with, well, look at what the policies really do, and you can figure out why they're advocating them.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jason Weeden, who joins us along with Robert Kurzban. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, the hour we set aside every week to dive in and dig into political issues. And in this hour, we are putting our psychology, or I should say our political beliefs, on the couch. Our guests have co-authored a book called The Hidden Agenda of the Political Mind, How Self-Interest Shapes Our Opinions and Why We Won't Admit It. We're going to take a very short break, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This just in, the Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act upholds Obamacare. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. We're doing several things in this hour. One is keeping up on this Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act upholding Obamacare. And as information comes in, I will share that with you. Also talking with Jason Weeden and Robert Kurzban about their new book, and it's called The Hidden Agenda of the Political Mind. Robert Kurzban is a professor of psychology, director of the Pennsylvania Laboratory for Experimental Evolutionary Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. And Jason Weeden is a senior researcher at the laboratory. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Just quoting from the screen here, the King v. Burwell case was the GOP's last chance to get a court ruling that would effectively gut the ACA. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy sided with the majority and wrote the opinion. So very interesting. I'm sure there will be much more on this decision today, and we'll be talking about it on Radio Times as well. Robert, I want to get to the part of your subtitle, How Self-Interest Shapes Our Opinions and Why We Won't Admit It! I added the exclamation point. What's the and why we won't admit it? What is that about?
Yeah, so in the context of many of these discussions and in politics, one of the things that people are obviously trying to do is persuade one another, particularly in modern democracies and so on. But probably that's true in lots of different contexts. People are trying to persuade other people to take their position and to have the policies that they like. A very unpersuasive argument is, let's do this because it's good for me. Right? People don't really find that to be particularly persuasive. A better argument is, let's do this because it's good for everybody, or because it's supported by this particular moral principle that we share, or because it's good for the country. And when you're making these arguments, it's very helpful to actually believe them in a sincere way. Even if it's not really the origin of your view, to say, look, I'm a principled guy. Here's the principle. We should all do this. So that prevents people from, we think, coming to terms and sort of introspecting about the origins of their beliefs.
Because what you're saying baseline is that we think we're right and they're wrong.
We think we're right, and we want people to be persuaded on the basis of the appeals to things like social justice and to social welfare and so on. It's very helpful to make an argument that comes from philosophy, comes from the heart, comes from even ideology to persuade people in your social circles. Whereas, again, it's not going to be useful to say, we should all do this because this is going to make me better off.
So how should we frame it? And what's a better way to frame it? Well, we want to persuade people.
Yeah, so I mean, we actually would say that what people are doing is actually very sensible in the context of political discourse, in the context of candidates, in the context of conversations at the water cooler. It's not a bad idea to make these arguments based on principles. Mm-hmm. But what we're trying to say in part is, as scientists trying to understand what's sort of really going on, you need to look deeper than what people say is motivating and is animating their opinion. You have to look deeper than that.
Go ahead, Chase.
Yeah, Rob and I have both made this analogy of, you should think of the human mind like a bureaucracy that has a PR department, it has a public relations department. And if you think about companies or political administrations, how do they do their decision making? Well, they have a set of objectives that are about helping themselves, helping their organization, helping the supporters of their organization. So if it's a company, it's helping the shareholders. If it's a presidential administration, it's helping your donors and your backers and your advocates. But then there's a public relations effort that goes on to say, okay, what's our message? How are we going to craft a message? And the corporation never says, oh, we've made this decision because it maximizes our profits. A corporation says, well, we've made this decision because we believe in being a good corporate citizen, right, and helping the community. And, you know, and political administrations do the same thing. They don't say, well, we made this decision because we have industry donors who want us to do this. They say, oh, we've made this decision because it's best for the country as a whole. Well, human minds do that innately. Human minds do that inherently. Human minds, you have a set of interests that are driving you. We all do. But you also have a public relations department in your mind that's creating a spin that's going to make you look good.
Well, I'm thinking too about parties, and as we know, there's much less loyalty to parties. It seems that people are more and more describing themselves as independents or some, you know, mix of various political beliefs. How does that fit into your thinking, Rob?
Well, one of the things that is very difficult is to predict these macro trends and to understand how these individual issues are going to shape the local political scene. So in many ways, that's something that's very difficult for us to understand. I think part of it is what you alluded to earlier, which is that there are certain parts of the population which they look at what appears to them to be homogeneity within the parties. They see that their views do not connect nicely in all those different respects, and so they're sort of left in the dark. You know, part of this interacts with the American political system, right? Because we have a first-past-the-post system, because we wind up then with a two-party system, you do wind up with all the sort of stuff that political scientists have talked about, right? So that you're going to have these parties that are going to try to get just to the right to appeal to the minimal winning coalition. And then that leaves many people, especially in the modern world, as things have become more complex, I think that leaves them in some sense not fitting nicely within those contexts.
Do you think that's why we have such a low voter turnout rate?
Well, that's a tough question. I think, you know, many people, yeah, people are disenchanted with the American political system. They see the gridlock. They get frustrated with it. Many people, of course, think that their vote doesn't matter on the margin. And so I think many of those, you know, there's probably a lot of different reasons that are explaining the somewhat lackadaisical performance of the American electorate.
Let me make a weird segue here, but you have a whole section here about who goes to church, who doesn't go to church, and why people in their 20s have their attendance has dropped off during this interesting decade in their life.
Well, it's an old pattern, it turns out. You know, the baby boomers did it you know, just in terms of the data we have available to us, the baby boomers did it, Gen X did it, and millennials have done it, where lots and lots of kids are raised religious, and it's because lots of parents go to church, and especially parents who have lots of kids go to church a lot. But then as you start hitting late teens and early 20s, church attendance, you know, so we looked at a data set of essentially of early millennials. About 40% of them had parents who went to church every week.
Right.
But by the time that three-quarters of those kids stopped going to church by the time they were in their mid-20s, three-quarters of them.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And basically, we have a set of research Rob and I have done with some other co-authors, Doug Kenrick at Arizona State, looking at what's, you know, what's going on, what's the attraction of religion, what's why do some people go to, you know, heavily affiliate with religious groups and other people don't, and what we find in this data is the reason a lot of teens in early 20s are leaving church, it's because churches support conservative lifestyles, churches support traditional lifestyles, and when people want to go party and hook up and sleep around and cohabit out of, outside of marriage, they will stop going to church because church is no longer for them. But it's also why a lot of parents with a lot of kids go to church, because church is for them. Church is supporting that traditional high fertility lifestyle. But when kids start partying and hooking up, they really just stop, you know, even if they're raised very religious, they will just stop going to church. And then that all intersects with politics, because there are a lot of political issues, abortion, same-sex marriage, birth control, that people think of as religious issues that people are getting from their religion. So I, you know, I've attended church a lot, and I've sat through these sermons, and they've taught me to be pro-life, and they've taught me to be anti-birth control. Well, what we find is there's this interesting contrast where, yeah, but the kinds of people who have less traditional lifestyles, a lot of them are raised religious, but they elect to stop going to church. And so there, it's not that their church-going childhood didn't cause them to be lifestyle conservatives. Their own lifestyle non-traditionalism led to liberal views on these lifestyle issues.
So so what it is by going to church, you are putting yourself into a situation that really contradicts how you are living your life.
Well, it would for that segment of the population. What Rob and I have talked about is church is like a tool. Religious organizations are like a tool. They're either useful for the way you live or they're not useful for the way you live. And if they are useful, you'll pick it up. You'll join that church. Mm-hmm. You'll stay joined to that church. But if it's not useful to your life, to your lifestyle, if it's not supporting the way you live, you'll abandon it.
And I guess the question is, do those people go back to church when they're in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and older?
What I've found in the data is the older people get, the less their church attendance has to do with their parental church attendance, and the more it has to do with their own lifestyles. Hmm. So when people start settling down and having more kids, a lot of them do start going to church, even if they didn't have particularly religious parents. Adopting that traditional lifestyle makes church attendance attractive. It makes church an attractive tool to support the lifestyle you've chosen.
You want to add to that?
No, except to say that, you know, one of the things that we try to articulate is that when we talk about these lifestyle choices, we want to be clear that these are real, you know, actual things that matter, right? So if you want to carefully control when you're going to have children and you live in an environment in which, you know, birth control is prohibited and so on, that's very difficult. So this is not an abstract set of issues that you know, being part of a church and so on can have very concrete influences on these really important decisions you're making in life.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Robert Kurzban, who joins us along with Jason Whedon, and we're talking about their new book on Ballot Talks on Radio Times, The Hidden Agenda of the Political Mind, How Self-Interest Shapes Our Opinions and Why We Won't Admit It. We'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I'm looking here to say, keeping up on the news that's happening outside the room here, the Supreme Court essentially upholding Obamacare. And Roberts, I'm just looking at some quotes here, Justice Anthony Kennedy, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan agreed. And I guess this is quoting from Chief Justice Roberts. Had Congress meant to limit tax credits to state exchanges, it likely would have done so in the definition of an applicable taxpayer or in some other prominent manner. It would not have used such a winding path to connect the dots provisions about the amount of the provision. I did a terrible job of reading that. I don't totally understand what the Chief Justice is saying, but it looks like we're talking about upholding Obamacare as it has been for the last couple of years. So you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. I wonder if we had a country – it's interesting to be talking about this as we're also talking about the Affordable Care Act. And I wonder if there's any connection that you've made, Rob, as we're trying to understand what's going on.
Well, I mean, actually,
headline-wise.
Yeah, that quote actually is interesting because it does connect in the sense that, you know, what Roberts sounds like he's saying is that it's difficult to interpret – that there's a difficulty in interpreting the intention, right? So this is what these guys are trying to unwind. And so from his point of view, he's basically saying if that was their intent, they could have said this very clearly in this other way. And that connects up to our point here, which is that intentions are difficult to unravel, mm-hmm. even in the context of our interactions with people. And so when I say I'm in favor of the Affordable Care Act in virtue of the fact that I think people should have access to reasonably priced health care, that might be true. That might be the basis of my opinion. But it also might be that, you know, I could get fired at any moment. And I kind of want to live in a world in which it would kind of be nice if, you know, the federal government were footing part of the bill against the chance that I were to lose my job or be in a situation in which I could benefit from it. So even in our day-to-day interactions, intentions are hard to discern.
You know, I was thinking as I was reading your book, thinking about the horror, the tragedy in Charleston, South Carolina, that when, you know, so many people were murdered in that church, and how so quickly this whole notion of the Confederate flag has changed. And these were, you know, very strongly held beliefs. We're hearing from some political leaders about what this flag stands for. And within a couple of days, all of a sudden, the opinion about that flag has changed so dramatically. And if we're talking about the hidden mind, do you think that was an issue just sort of waiting to be changed?
I don't think that we could have had such quick flipping on this issue had there not been a large amount of residual sort of readiness for this change. I mean, I was also struck by the speed with which prominent people seem to change their view on this and the pace of change. And what that suggests is that, again, it suggests that lots of people didn't know that large numbers of other people also felt that this change was in order. And so, again, you know, this problem where people don't wear their beliefs, they don't wear their opinions on their sleeves. And so it becomes very difficult to know exactly what other people, either as individuals or in aggregate, are thinking at any given time.
So that when, let's say, someone like a Nikki Haley, you know, who apparently had supported this, changes her mind in such a public way, that sort of opens the door for other people to say, you know, when you really come down to it, I'm going to change my mind too.
Yeah, there's a price to be paid in the political discourse with being out of sync with the rest of people's views. And that's true whether you're a political leader or in the social context in which you find yourself. And so as leaders voice these views and as you have larger numbers of other people voicing these views, that makes the endorsement of that view yourself to be quite a bit safer than it would have been had you been a voice in the wilderness.
Let me see what John from Philadelphia has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. This might be a little bit of a backtrack as to where the conversation has gone, but I had a question as to how your guests necessarily define self-interest. Because if we're talking about this in the context of, you know, humans having evolved to function best socially, isn't even something like altruism or what would appear to be altruism a form of self-interest? And how do you distinguish self-interest from any other kind of interest or whether or not there's even anything other than self-interest?
No, it's a great question, John. It hangs over a conversation like this. Did you hear that, Rob?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we do broaden the definition of self-interest. If you look at our friends over in economics, for example, they often restrict it to things having to do with short-term financial self-interest. And what we want to say is no, that the world actually involves other sorts of things that people care about. To connect it back to the conversation about religion, one thing that's in my interest, if I'm engaging in a particular kind of lifestyle, is trying to maintain strict control over when I get pregnant and when I have my kids and so on. So there, the issues of abortion and birth control for us are within the scope of what's in my interest in the sense that those are goals that I have that I want to try to achieve that can be facilitated or undermined by statute, by legislation at different levels. So we expand it to include things like control over my reproduction. We expand it to mean I kind of like people in my group. As you were saying, I'm a tribal critter. I kind of like other people who are sort of like me to be better off if I can swing that. And then, of course, also it includes economic self-interest. So from
But there is another side to that, which is people that also feel very passionately that, you know, if we're talking about abortion, that this is murder, or that, you know, this is sinful, that what you're doing is ending a life.
Well, so our view on that is that, again, we want to be careful because people say that's the origin of their view on abortion does not actually mean that that's the origin of their view on abortion. It turns out that the best person, some of the best work in the world, in my opinion, on this topic was actually done by Jason. And what he finds is that if you want to figure out what people's views on abortion are going to be, what you want to look at basically, again, is going to be stuff about what their reproductive goals are, about how they want to live their sexual lives. So I'm just saying, just because people talk about it in the context of this ideology. And by the way, just as an aside here, I do want to add one small point as anecdotal evidence. You know, you look at a particular congressman who I won't name, whose girlfriend, actually mistress, got into some trouble. And here's a person who is philosophically, at least on his webpage, deeply pro-life. But when his interest is undermined, right, when his mistress is going to have a problem, he endorses, he advocates, he encourages her to get an abortion. It's hard to believe that he in some sense, truly endorses this view that abortion is murder if that was the advice he was going to give to his mistress.
And we're almost having a break here. Don't we call those people hypocrites?
We do. We do. And I have obviously quite a bit to say about that.
Indeed. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. John, thanks for the call to the show. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, our guests are Robert Kurzban and Jason Whedon. Their book is The Hidden Agenda of the Political Mind, How Self-Interest Shapes Our Opinions and Why We Won't Admit It. Much more after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Just to recap in this edition of Ballot Talks, while media outlets and polls and dinner table conversations might lead one to believe that voting and political alignment are based on things like ideology and abstract ideas about justice, our guests in this hour of the show have a very different take. They argue that voters are mostly driven by self-interest and the direct result of legislation and policies on themselves. And again, they are Robert Kurzban and Jason Whedon, and their book is The Hidden Agenda of the Political Mind. Let me get Ed from, looks like Villanova, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Ed. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, I see nothing at all wrong with voting your self-interest. How else are you supposed to vote? Second of all, voting really doesn't mean much. They're now more than ever, there are billionaires behind the scenes who really control policies, all the important policies, for instance, war and peace. And that's about all I have to say.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I think many people, obviously Ed and I think many other, just are completely frustrated with voting anyway, saying perhaps it doesn't even hold up under this analysis because people are so turned off.
Yeah, so just to be clear about what we're saying, we're not actually saying it's a bad thing for people to identify their self-interest and to argue for their position and, in fact, to vote in that direction. So our claim is really not a normative claim. We're not trying to say what you should or shouldn't do. We're trying to understand what people do. And mm-hmm. So I take the first point. There's certainly nothing wrong intrinsically either with having an opinion or voting that way. The next thing I would say is that I it's very easy to be cynical about the political process, right? So here I think we're all sort of with Churchill where we say that democracy is sort of a horrible form of government and only virtue is that it's better than all the others. And but of course, right, the political system is complex and obviously there are special interests and there's lots lots of money in politics. We're not really trying to speak to that issue, but I do want to just say that, of course, we empathize with the general perspective.
I'm curious, too, and I'll put this to you, Jason, if we had policies that were just based on public opinion and what people cared about versus what actually we end up when it goes to the legislative process, would we be living in a very different country?
Yeah, sure. It's there's been a pretty highly publicized literature coming out of academia about the preferences of the wealthy. I mean, this goes back to what the caller was saying. The wealthier people, more educated people, are more likely to have their policies represented by government. And those policies are essentially libertarian-ish. They're a little more conservative than what the public wants on economic issues, but they're also a little more liberal than what the public wants on lifestyle issues, on discrimination issues. So, sure, if you had, you know, look, my fellow liberals will often say, well, it would be great if we had more public opinion ruling legislation, because then liberal economic policies would win. Yeah, be very careful with that, because also discriminatory, anti-immigrant policies would win. School prayer would be allowed. Abortion would be illegal in lots and lots and lots of states. So you have to be careful about, you know, does any one side really say, oh, well, public opinion favors our side? No, public opinion favors a more downscale constituency that's a little more conservative socially, but a little more liberal economically.
Oh, interesting. You want to add to that at all?
No, I mean, it is one of these cases where you do want to be careful what you wish for. And again, one of the things we want to try to say is that even knowing about political opinion data, of course, it intersects with the political institutions that we have in this country. And so the fact that the wealthier are those policies are given greater voice, of course, this is a function of the way that we have organized our political system. And this is inevitable.
What does it mean then to call oneself a Democrat or a Republican? Or have we sort of lost the thread of that?
Yeah, well, actually, I think, you know, the political science literature will tell you it has, in fact, become more meaningful to be a Democrat or Republican because the parties represent more issues than they used to. You know, prior to the Civil Rights Acts, the parties had different views on economics. You had the FDR coalition that was, you know, in favor of laborers and farmers, and then you had the Republican coalition that was in favor of business interests. But then as you get into the civil rights era, now the parties divide up issues of race and civil rights. And then you get into the late 70s and early 80s, and now the parties before had no positions on abortion. You start getting to the late 70s, early 80s, the parties adopt these contrasting positions on abortion. You get into the 90s, the parties start adopting contrasting positions on immigration. So in fact, party labels mean a lot more than they used to, but then this goes back to a point you raised earlier in the conversation, which is, but then you also get a lot of people saying, well, I don't really agree with either one of them. Now that these parties have so many opinions, it gets less and less likely that any given individual agrees with all of those opinions. So you get a lot more people saying, you know, I'm not really represented by either one of these parties in a way that I feel fully comfortable with.
You have a chapter in here where you talk about the Democratic Party and African Americans, you know, largely vote Democratic. They tend to be probably more religious than whites. And you also talk about the rich heathens, rich white heathens, I guess, in the Democratic Party. I mean, what a strange sort of bedfellows on some level.
Yeah, exactly. So the Democratic Party has become the party of sort of not the Republican Party. And so the economically liberal side of the Democratic Party is represented by the groups that you just mentioned. And the socially liberal part of the Democratic Party is represented by the other groups that you alluded to, including minorities and so on. And so in many ways, again, because you have a two-party system, you wind up with a movement towards what, you know, both are trying to get to the minimum winning coalition, right? So they're trying to draw in people by virtue of taking positions that are going to speak to those particular portions. And of course, this is one of the reasons the parties start adopting positions on issues which heretofore were irrelevant, right? Because they want to use those to draw other people into their voting bloc.
Let me get, looks like Ian from Cherry Hill to join us on Radio Times. And Ian, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
Hi
there.
Well, I agree with them with your guest primarily. I think people vote based on whatever narrative they can trust reality, and I think that has a lot to do.
Oh, we lost Ian. I'm afraid
information they locked into.
Yeah, what I'm, you know, unfortunately we don't have the greatest phone line, but he's, I'm looking at the screen here, mostly agrees with the guests, but more based on the narrative of the media. And this is the point in the show where you get to criticize the media, I guess, for how it frames issues and perhaps sort of feeds more disagreement maybe than actually exists. Jason?
Well, I mean, there are two sides to that coin. One is, yeah, there are always framing effects. There are always media effects. These, you know, it matters what has become part of the conversation, what is not. But on the other hand, we go look at the public opinion data and we see lots of very deep demographic connections that can't plausibly be fully media driven. So you look at differences between whites and African Americans and views on criminal justice and views on affirmative action and views on certain kinds of government services. Those divisions are really widespread and they're based on racial categories. And so this is not just something the media by a whim creates. Now, the media can bring it to the fore. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had incidents, obviously, in the past several months involving criminal justice where these racial divisions get exposed. And then you probably see some changes. You probably see some, for example, some white Democrats might look at that and say, oh, you know, I hadn't realized this was such an important issue to some of my fellow Democratic coalition members. And so, yeah, I'm going to take a fresh look at law enforcement issues and adjust my views on that. But the media didn't create the issue in the first place. The issue existed. And similarly with things like abortion or same-sex marriage, these, you know, or redistribution issues, these things exist without the media telling you. The media can highlight them, can create some subtle shifts in public opinion, but the differences, the core differences in the public existed before the media got there.
We did a show not so long ago about how the ACLU and the Koch brothers have come together because of their concerns about our criminal justice system and the fact that we have so many people in prison and so many people with criminal records, which is interesting to think about in this sort of self-interested frame that we're using, is that they each had their own reasons for their position, but had come together on probably one of the lone things that they might agree on.
Right. It's hard to imagine too much more that those particular groups are going to come together on. But this actually connects to a remark that Jason made earlier, which is that there's this fairly substantial growing streak of libertarianism, particularly in when it comes to issues of social equality, social justice, and so forth. I mean, you look at what's going on with gay marriage, and in a very short period of time, as these things go, people – obviously, this flipped very, very fast. Mm-hmm. And the narrative, and I think quite properly, is about people's freedom, people's ability to make contracts if they wish. And of course, if you're the Koch brothers, what you care about is freedom in a particular way, which is a little different from what the ACLU might think. But the ACLU is also has that streak, right? That's part of their core mission.
Yep.
And so they're brought together on this issue. And it speaks again to the point that, look, you know, the world is complicated. And in the current political system, you do wind up with, as you say, these very strange bedfellows.
Let me see what Karen from Green Lane has to say. Hi, Karen. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I would like to respectfully disagree with the tone of the conversation. And I just would like to say that my husband and I both are extreme value voters. We are evangelical Christians. We consider ourselves progressives. And but we vote mostly what we consider for the least of these. We are middle income, but yet we vote in order to help those who are poor, those who are struggling for civil rights, those who are imprisoned. I homeschool my kids, yet I vote for funding for schools tremendously. I'm very involved with that because I care about other people's children as well. That's how we build a big society, a good, healthy society. So I just wanted to register that opinion, and I'll keep the comments off the air.
No, I appreciate the call, Karen, both of our guests predicted that people would take issue with some of the things we've been talking about.
Yeah, again, I would go back to the the analogy of, you know, global warming. It can be true that the planet's getting warmer as you average across lots of different times and places, but it can still be true that you can get very unusually cold days and unusually cold winters and unusually cold places that are getting colder rather than warmer, even though average temperatures are getting warmer. It's the same thing with social science on public opinion. Your caller does, in fact, have a very interesting, unique perspective, and it's one you don't see a lot of when you go look at the data. You don't see a lot of that.
Maybe we need more Karens.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, sounds good to me, but again, we're looking at large data sets and saying, okay, what are the averages? And it turns out the averages work out in a way where I think most people, once they see these different kinds of patterns, see the patterns on immigration, see the patterns on abortion, see the patterns on healthcare, they all agree, yeah, those patterns look roughly self-interested, again, on average, on the whole.
I mean, people do take statistics personally, don't they, Robert?
Right. I mean, it would be weird. I mean, I completely credit the remarks too that Karen made, and I think, you know, obviously it's really nice for people to think about other people when they're casting their vote and when they're doing doing whatever it is they're going to do in their communities and their societies and so on. But again, you know, our view is it would be funny if people called in and said, "Oh my God, you know what? Geez, I am just the most selfish."
People don't say that.
Yeah, no one's going to call and say, "Oh, you totally nailed me. I just do whatever is good for me, and I don't really care about other people." And but that's not at all to minimize, you know, her agenda and what she's up to. It's just that again, this is. If what we're saying is right, this is sort of what we would expect. Mm.
And this is the why we won't admit it part of the title. Let me get Linda from what looks like Cape May to join us. Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Earlier you were talking about, or someone brought up, the voter cynicism. And I just wanted to comment that unless someone is interested in running for office as a member of one of two major political parties, they don't seem to get a fair chance. They're not vetted properly. They don't get the same media coverage. The two parties block them from political debates and so forth. And I think a lot of people want to look at an alternative to one of the major parties rather than either not voting or voting, choosing the lesser of two evils, so to speak. And thank you for the show.
You're welcome.
Love it. And I will take any comments off here.
Absolutely. Can I? Who? I'm tossing it back to you, Rob.
Yeah. So I certainly, again, I see the point. And what I would say is that the two-party system that we have is really a product of the institutions. It has to do with the fact that we've got a first-past-the-post voting system. If you look at parliamentary systems, then they have more parties, and so people might fit more naturally. And so there you do see third, fourth, and fifth parties and so on. I would say a minor footnote, third parties in this country occasionally have had an effect on elections. I mean, political scientists have identified a few of those effects. But it's certainly true that because you've got a first-past-the-post system, there is an advantage to a party. You know, you're going to wind up with this split. And it does have some unpleasant consequences.
I'm looking, quoting actually from near the end of your book, from our perspective, we would point out that we found strong relationship between politics and various demographic items that are clearly related to genes items. I mean, are we really just talking about genes and politics here?
Well, right. Okay. So there's the new hot thing in political science is to talk about genetics. And in fact, you go look at these twin studies where you compare identical twins with fraternal twins. And yes, the identical twins are a lot more similar than the fraternal twins on lots of different political items. And the question is, okay, how in the world can things like your views on school prayer be genetic? Is there a school prayer gene? Is there an abortion opinion gene? And we make a point late in the book. It's not central to what we were talking about in the book, but we just wanted to mention it because everybody's talking about genes these days. We just wanted to mention that we have a lot of demographic items that predict political opinions pretty well. And a lot of those demographic items relate to things that people know are genetic, even including, interestingly, religiosity, your views about, you know, sexual lifestyles, you know, how sort of much you sleep around or don't sleep around. These things, in fact, you can go to behavioral genetic studies and they're highly genetically inheritable.
Well, we're out of time, but I do want to quote something from our page here. I vote to help other people, but it's my self-interest because it makes me feel good. Make sense to you, Rob?
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
Fair enough. Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Jason Whedon, Robert Kurzban. The book is called The Hidden Agenda of the Political Mind, How Self-Interest Shapes Our Opinions and Why We Won't Admit It. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter, how to sign up for our newsletter. I'm Marty Moscoene. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Don't go away, though. We'll be right back with our second hour.